Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Video Store Nightmares, the podcast where we discuss the strange, the bizarre, and the convoluted films of the VHS era. Tonight, we are talking about a sort of Eurocrime action thriller romance from 1984, White Fire. My name is Luke, and I'm joined by Leland.
Listeners, you can find 1984's White Fire on YouTube and sometimes on Tubi.
So this film was co-written and directed by a French director. I think this was primarily a French production, although the actors are from all over the place, as was common in these fully dubbed movies. But the director is French. His name is Jean-Marie Pilardi, if I'm pronouncing that right. Were you familiar with this guy at all before seeing this movie?
Not in the slightest.
Yeah, me neither. This is the only film of his I've seen. It looks like mostly he directed like softcore porn. Do you see any, like, does that shine through this film at all, do you think?
Yeah, it does make certain plot points a little bit more explainable as to why they're there.
I also think there's a, I don't know, some of the tone of this movie. Let me put it this way. There are moments where it feels like the primary purpose of the movie is the romance, which seems odd for this kind of movie. But maybe if you're used to directing softcore porn, that's kind of where your eye and ear go.
I mean, let's just be up front, right? The only reason that we're covering this film is because of the romance plot. Because otherwise, this is sort of a I wouldn't say completely run of the mill, but it's a very textbook Eurocrime film, save for the side plots.
Yeah, but it has a lot of them, and they're it like I said, it's quite convoluted. And there's a lot of strands that come together. Of the large cast of characters, who do you think we need to talk about? Like, who stood out to you?
Really, in the script, it's completely chock full of characters. You really only need to pay attention about, I don't know, 20% of them, maybe.
That's fair.
You got the protagonists, the main two, brother and sister, the main villain, the manager at the factory, and then Fred Williamson's character, and then maybe Proxy's sister. You know, that's five characters, and you can basically ignore everyone else. They're mostly just goons and hired thugs in various forms of costume.
Yeah, so let's go through those major players. The main character, Bo, he's played by Robert Ginty, who is an American actor. I find this performance sort of bland, like it's sort of one note throughout the movie. But I also recognize that it's hard to gauge because of the dubbing. I think he's dubbing himself, but it's a layer removed from the action.
Is Bo a complex character with multiple layers? I mean, he does have his own character arc throughout the film.
Yeah, I mean, he starts as sort of a, I thought of him as like an Indiana Jones knockoff, where he had like, you know, he was searching diamond mines for treasure and throwing away one-liners, right? But then he enters his like tragic grief-stricken phase, where that becomes the defining quality of his character. And then he kind of becomes an action hero at the end. Did you buy this as a character arc? Was this believable to you?
Well, much like Indiana Jones, he also hits women.
Oh, there's a lot of slapping of women in this movie. Yeah.
As expected from Italian cinema.
I think it's French. I think this was a French production.
Oh, there's more than one culture we can blame here. I think it was a joint, like Italian, French, and apparently Turkish production.
Well,
Somehow, three countries had their fingers in this pot, and this is the movie we got.
and Robert Genty came from America, so make it four. One thing I noticed is most of this movie is supposed to take place in Istanbul, Turkey. There are no deserts in Istanbul. Like when I was watching this movie, I kept getting so confused about, like, I didn't know if the diamond mine, where that was located in relation to the city, because it makes it look like it's like right there, and yet there's all of this desert. And that's because they actually were filming like war, or I don't know how much was filmed in Turkey, but they would have been like 8,000 miles away.
A lot of the urban shots are in Turkey because the director makes a very painstakingly obvious effort after certain scenes to just pan into the skyline to monuments that are in Istanbul.
Right.
But no, you're otherwise you're right. It's kind of like a, I don't want to say necessarily Hollywood because this is a European film, but it's kind of like that Hollywood expectation that everywhere in the Middle East is a desert. Every Arab country is a Muslim country is somehow in a desert, regardless of actual location.
Yeah. To get back to the performances, the main two women in the cast are Belinda Main and Diana Goodman. That's Ingrid and Olga. And for reasons that will become clear, they're pretty similar characters. I don't think either of these actresses had much of a career beyond this movie. What did you think about them?
I think from all the cast, there's a certain level of professionalism that's required to be able to pull off the romance subplot with any degree of seriousness. And I would say that Bo and both of the women are able to pull that off. They make me convinced that they were able to rise above the subject matter and give a performance that's worthy of a film. If nothing else.
I hadn't thought about this until you just said that, but the romance in the film and to some degree the dynamics between all the characters are very like soap opera-ish, but the more extreme ridiculous soap opera, like when I was a kid my mom watched Guiding Light, I think that's what it was called. But I remember, sometimes it would be on in the background when I was a kid, and it started out with just like, normal couples. There was some cheating on one another or whatever. But then it started like characters came back from the dead, and characters were cloned, and evil twins were discovered, and like all the, because they have to figure out a way to keep the story going. Right. And sometimes this feels like that.
Agreed. I did not make that comparison watching the film, but you're right.
I think the best performance in the movie by far is Fred Williamson. If people aren't familiar with Fred Williamson, he was a football player. He later became an actor, and during the height of the Blaxploitation film industry, like he's in a lot of those movies. And then when that waned, he went to Europe. And so he's in a lot of these European, especially crime and Western films. He has a screen presence. And I think his performance is good enough that he kind of steals all of the scenes he's in.
Pound for pound, he is the best actor overall in the film. But when you watch his scenes, it feels like this movie was probably written without him and his character. And then somehow the director found out that he could cast Fred Williamson and then hard wrote him into the script. His side story feels completely unnecessary to everything that's going on.
Yeah, and yet like in the last quarter of the movie, he really takes over the film. Like he seems to be the primary one guiding a lot of the action. He's like the big bad that the movie suddenly comes up with. It's just strange that the attention shifts so strongly to him.
Not to get too far ahead in the plot, but when this movie does conclude, you know, we never see the main antagonists actually get taken out, right? Like there's the big shootout at the end, and you know, the mafia is involved, but the final scene of the movie doesn't even involve them. It involves Fred Williamson's character, Bo, and then Bo and Proxy Sister.
Yeah, I definitely have some unresolved questions, but that's kind of what I'm getting at is up until Fred Williamson comes into the movie, this is really a conflict between a pair of diamond thieves, that's Bo and his sister Ingrid, and the diamond mine that they're both working at, but also double crossing by, siphoning off diamonds. And that's the focus. And then we're also introduced to this like mafia subplot with Sophia. What did you think of this storyline?
Now, this feels like the original script, right? Is there's really four major players in this movie. Again, the plot is so convoluted, especially for a Eurocrime film. But you have the good mafia, which involves our heroes, the bad mafia, which includes Sophia, the diamond mine, which has a crooked manager that's in league with the protagonist, but is also double crossing them with the bad mafia. And then you have Fred Williamson. He's his own group. He's the entire operation. And his objectives, his goals are completely different from the other three. So when you're watching this movie for the first time, it can be a little daunting trying to put all that together. Because despite the fact that this movie is 1 hour and 40 minutes long, some things go by really fast and other things go by really slow. And none of those slow things involve the plot.
So this is my first time watch, and I'm really glad you said both of those things because I'm happy to know I'm not alone in having a hard time following some of this plot and figuring out what the motivations of everyone was. And two, I too felt like parts of this movie are so boring. Like I really struggled to get through them. And then there are other parts that are batshit crazy and are action-packed and do not let up and throw plot twists at you. And it's a very weird, like, stop and go, stop and go, stop and go. It just, I don't know. It's a tension. It's an unresolved tension. It's frustrating.
So this is definitely not my first watch, but what th this viewing, I was able to parse together more of what was going on in the last half of the film. That doesn't mean I don't have questions. There are still questions, even if you know what's happening. But a second viewing goes a long way in trying to piece this film together.
Yeah, I felt that. And I also finished watching it like 30 minutes before we sat down to have this conversation. So it's very fresh in my mind, and yet maybe after thinking about it, I would have greater clarity. We'll see. We'll see if this conversation helps. Before we play the trailer, I do think we need to talk about the music. So I don't know who was involved in the songs. IMDb says the musical director was John Lord, but that's all I know. But the dominating music in this film is a pair of songs. One is a theme song, and the other one is like a romantic ballad, and both are used pervasively in the film. Let's play a clip of the theme song so people can hear what we're talking about.
Fight, fight, fire.
Rolling like a thunderball through the wall.
Yeah, there's some mixed metaphors going on. But what do you think of this song?
Every time I see diamonds, a little bit of this song plays in my head. Like, not the actual, like, lyrics, just like the why fire? And then it, like, kind of goes into the drum beat.
Yeah, I hope that doesn't happen to me. I'm not a fan of this song. Like, this is the worst of that 80s trend where movies had theme songs. Like, sometimes that worked out really, really well. And there are some horror films, especially, where I find them very charming. But I don't think this one works.
Oh, no way. It works here. But also keep in mind that I think White Fire is only this movie's English title.
How did you... Yeah, the IMDb says the original title was, I can't speak the French, but Vive pour survive, something like that.
Live to survive, I think.
Oh, maybe that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, within the original context of the film, it doesn't have, the song doesn't have the title of the film, right?
That's a good point. I wonder if the song was added for the American release.
Maybe.
I don't know. I guess I should have done more research.
It's okay. No one's going to care.
This is an aside, but this was released on Transworld Video. If you're a video collector, I think you're familiar with Transworld. They mostly released things in those big clamshells with the square edges, not the rounded edges. So they're quite distinctive on a shelf. Not crazy rare tapes, but I think there's a lot of cool stuff on that label. And I find it really interesting that this got a VHS release, you know, that early on. The romantic song. I'm sorry to say that I like this one even less.
Oh no.
How do you feel about this one?
All right, so I'm not going to be humming that one to myself in the shower, but it's not really about the songs themselves that really make them shine in this movie. It's about all of the inappropriate situations in which they're played by the director.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's the director or the editor or the Ted Post, the music, whoever made the decisions for where to cue the music in the film, they should not have made another film.
Maybe they didn't. We don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe Arrow put out a Blu-ray of this. Maybe check that out because it might have, you know, interviews or stuff on it. I'll have to do some research. But in the meantime, let's play the trailer and talk about this ridiculous story.
When Robert Beatty, star of The Exterminator, and Fredrik Wilson from The Bronx Warriors meet head-on in their quest for the fabulous 200-carat diamond, White Fire, the screen erupts in high-powered violence. But other corrupt forces also want the priceless gem, resulting in an onslaught of brute forces and ruthless conflict. Suspense and action are interwoven into a web of bloodletting adventure. White Fire, a total screen detonation.
That was a Australian VHS trailer for White Fire. And despite the fact that I played that at full fucking volume, it sounded like it was coming from inside a freezer.
I'll do my best to fix that so that listeners will hear a better version. But let's quickly talk about this opening scene. You know, most of the movie takes place 20 years later. So this opening scene has our protagonist, Bo and Ingrid, twins, right? As children. What did you think about this as a backstory?
So I know from promotional material after watching this film that Bo and Ingrid are supposed to be Russian. Did that ever occur to you while watching this film?
No, I did get the impression that they were supposed to be foreign in some way, like that they were from a different country, but there's no indication where that might be.
So here's the reason I bring that up. This scene has absolutely no outside context. You have Bo, Ingrid, and their parents being chased through the woods by an generically uniformed camoed military soldiers. But there's nothing that shows like where they're from, why they're chasing civilians through the woods, or anything like that. After I read that they were Russian, I was trying to put together if there was maybe some kind of, I don't know, military conflict that involved like a bunch of refugees leaving Russia for Turkey, but I don't think so. I don't think there's anything like that.
Yeah, I don't know my European geopolitics well enough, but you know, what I find striking about that, having a scene like this is not unusual in this kind of movie, right? Lots of 80s and 90s action movies and horror movies as well, by the way, have a scene in the beginning with the protagonist as a child, witnessing something horrible or experiencing an awful tragedy, and then this somehow shapes their behavior or their emotions in the present. And so we see flashbacks to it throughout the movie. But usually that childhood trauma is resolved in some way by the rest of the plot. Like it has a relevance in the present day. But that's not the case here, at least not that I was able to discern. As far as I can tell, this first scene has absolutely nothing to do with anything else that happens in the movie.
This scene does two things. One, it makes the kids orphans so that they can be easily picked up and groomed by an organized crime syndicate. To they eventually become diamond thieves or grifters, you know, because their parents are dead. The other is, I think there is a lasting trauma for Bo through the film where he relives the experience of losing his family. And that is like the most terrifying thing in the world to him. Like he doesn't want to lose his sister. And then once he does lose his sister, he doesn't want to lose his proxy sister and keeps reliving this scene in small bits. I wouldn't say it's pointless, but the genericness of zero context of this conflict kind of bothers me. Like, why are they being chased? There's no explanation.
Like, this would have been so easy. So imagine the group at the beginning work for the diamond company, and whoever the like leader of this militia was, he's now the manager. And not only have they infiltrated this organization to steal diamonds, it's also a form of revenge for the trauma and the loss of their parents. Like, if it just had a connection like that, I'm not like that would be silly too, but everything else in the movie is silly. So you might as well make it like dramatically satisfying.
No, you see, that's way too connected. You have to put at least another 3 degrees of character relationships between those two to meet the convoluted criteria of this film.
Ordinarily, one of my standards for high quality filmsmanship is not efficiency, but in this case, we needed some plot efficiency. There were there the circuitous routes that they took to get to some of these conclusions, unnecessary. But anyway, so they're orphans now, and we go to the present day.
It's just, they're so generically evil. Like, the one soldier shoots the mom on the beach, and then just kind of, like, sits there and smiles, admires his work.
Oh, and we left out that they're only saved because, like, the soldiers were going to shoot them, too. Like, the kids, I think. But somebody approaches behind the guy with the gun and snaps his neck.
It's like you're saying, it was like a local militia group. I don't even know if this is probably not in Turkey, right?
No, I didn't get that impression. I got
there's a fucking shoreline.
Yeah. I got the impression that this was whatever country the kids were from.
Yeah, so they end up getting rescued by is his name Mike?
Sam,
that's kind of like Mike. Yeah, so they get rescued by Sam, who ends up again, like, indoctrinating them into the life of organized crime after they flee this country. So it does come back.
Yeah, I mean, in that sense, but that's not quite what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I know, it's not satisfying, but it's there.
So
anyway, 20 years later.
Yeah, so let me ask you some questions, because I'm immediately confused here. So we start with Ingrid, and she's going into, like, where she presumably works, which is this diamond mining company, factory, whatever. What else is going on in here? Because we see a lot of strange things that don't seem to have anything to do with diamond mining.
So let's get this out of the way now. 20 years later, very vague. We don't know what year it was prior, but this diamond mine has some like 1970s sci-fi prop shit going on. So I think this is supposed to be like the future as perceived by the 80s.
Oh. Okay, well, that would explain some things.
Right, the some things. This diamond mine is some serious fucking business, because it seems like they have their own private military force. And we're led to believe in the very beginning that Ingrid is just another employee at the plant. We eventually find out that her and her brother are in cahoots with the manager to stream out diamonds, sell them on the black market, and you know, to skim some profit off the top. But we don't know that in the beginning. So she reports to the office, and while she's walking to the manager's to the manager's floor, we see her go through like a very intricate like security process, and then she gets to watch one of her coworkers get tortured to death because he was caught stealing diamonds. And it's done to the White Fire theme song, which is so bizarre to watch a man get tortured to death to White Fire, White Fire.
Yeah, I was very unsure of what was going on at this point. And like some of the guards or whatever they are who work in this building, like, they look like stormtroopers, right? Or actually, what they look more like the Spaceballs from Spaceballs. They have these really goofy helmets. And there's the thing she gets in where, like, it, you know, the round little chamber she gets in, is that an elevator or is that like a cleansing process of some kind?
It looks like some kind of decomposition chamber, or like a metal detector, or maybe a diamond detector. And that's how they caught this guy.
I couldn't tell if we were supposed to think that she was somehow traveling to a different floor. Like,
no. I mean, she does get in the elevator eventually, but not there. But the whole purpose of the scene is the viewer is kind of like led to believe that she is going to be stealing diamonds, but she just saw what happens to somebody who got caught stealing diamonds. So when she does get to the manager's office and it's clear that there's probably some diamonds on her that she has stolen, you know, we're supposed to be like, oh no, is that going to happen to her if the manager finds out? Because the manager acts very, very creepy in this first scene, and then he acts like a normal person the rest of the film. I think it's because they're trying to build that false sense of tension.
It's really ominous. Before she leaves, he's like, I hope you enjoy your drive along the mountain road. And it really seems like she's going to be taken out, right?
Well, sort of, because he's in cahoots with the mafia, the local mafia, the Turkish Italian mafia.
I have no idea. I don't know who anyone is aligned with.
The ethnically ambiguous local evil mafia. It's not full of white people. He is in cahoots with them for some reason. I think because he feels like he can make more money. That part's not quite clear. I don't see why this guy would have the motivation to turn on his original organized crime syndicate. Like at all, right?
Yeah, I was really confused about his motivations the whole movie.
I think it's supposed to be more money, but it's never really explained. I guess what's important is that he's a scumbag. That's the important part that the audience needs to know. Oh no, he's hurting our favorite protagonists that we were just introduced to.
So can we move to after she escapes, or we think she escapes with the diamonds? Her and Bo are sort of captured by the what we've been calling the mafia, the people aligned with Sophia. What did you think of this whole introduction to them? Like most things in the movie, it begins with a shootout.
It begins with a shootout, right? There's a lot of parts of this film where the villains could have just shot the main characters and they would have been justified, but they couldn't do it because the movie would be over.
Oh, totally.
This is one of those scenes because they take Bo out of the Jeep and they have him at gunpoint, and then he starts fighting them. And then once they got Bo back under control, instead of, I don't know, just killing him or beating the shit out of him, they just let him go.
One thing this movie really reminded me of in many different ways is like a 70s Hong Kong kung fu movie where, yes, there's a plot, but it's really to string together martial arts fights, because that's how this movie feels sometimes. It's like it's not just that he puts up a fight and then they capture him and tie him up. It's they fight, they capture him, he gets away, and they fight again. Then he gets captured, then she comes in and they fight, and it's all to set up fist fights or round kicking.
The very like the first quarter of the film is definitely like that. It does taper off.
Yeah, there's a romantic he romance heavy middle section that I also think really drags down the film. But let's not get there yet. Let's start with Sophia.
So here's the thing, right? Like, Sophia here wants to extort these two diamond thieves so that they can get another source, another grift source for revenue in their, well, I guess their implied wide criminal activity market, right? Like that's the whole point. And Bo and Ingrid are not having it, so of course they fight back. Ingrid knocks out Sophia with one of those like Star Trek double fist to the shoulder strikes that should like never hurt somebody. And then they take their stolen diamonds, well, now twice stolen diamonds, and hightail it out of there. But that would be too easy for this movie. Instead, the local dock workers, who I guess are also organized crime, but don't have firearms, try to stop them with regular ass dock equipment, right? Like there's a dude with a hook and a rope, and he's swinging it around like that's gonna, that like that's a, an efficient martial arts weapon.
That's what I'm getting at, is like there's no reason the dock workers should attack in this scene, but because it's just an excuse to set up a fight scene.
Well, I mean, speaking of excuses, why didn't they just kill like the entire head of the mafia operation while they had them unconscious, right?
I was really confused by that, because they don't hesitate in wiping everybody else out.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. At first, I was like, okay, well, maybe this is supposed to be like a thief with morals or something. But then he picks up a chainsaw and starts eviscerating dock workers.
Yeah, but like later on, when they go, when what is it, Bo? When Bo and Ingrid go and meet with Sam, the three of them are like, oh, well, I guess they know about our operation. We have to be partners now. And like seem resigned to it after they just killed like 20 people.
I don't think it was 20 people, but it was a significant body count.
Yeah, and so it just I wasn't clear what the dynamic was going to be between these two groups going forward. But Sophia as a character, she's Italian. They make a point of explaining that she's the Italian lady or something. What did you think of her as like a villain?
They didn't give her enough screen time to really establish herself as a threatening figure.
Yeah, I really thought at this scene, I really thought she was going to become a major character. But then the rest of the movie, she just kind of stands around.
Yeah, you know, I think you can say that about a lot of the characters that aren't Bo and Ingrid or Ingrid adjacent, is that they steal probably like 80% of the screen time, right? And it leaves so little of the film to try to establish the other characters. Like, I feel like Sophia could have been more fleshed out. Instead, she just seems like, I don't know, cardboard figurehead. Which is unfortunate. They really could have done a cool femme fatale thing with her.
Yeah, that's one of the problems, and I know I've said this on the show before, but that's one of the problems with having too many characters, is if you've got this many characters, you can't devote enough time to the ones that actually matter. And as a result, I really don't care about any of these characters, which is really a letdown to me, because in some ways this movie is so wacky and bonkers that like I should love it, but I can't really, because the characters are so nothing.
Oh, nothing's a little strong. I think weak, kind of weak, but they're not nothing.
Now, I recognize that this is a function of the plot, but the two main female characters in this movie are interchangeable.
That's literally the point.
I get that, but it's not just that they look alike. It's that if you asked me what differentiates them as people or how are their personalities different, I couldn't tell you.
That's the point.
I don't know. I mean, even if that is 100% intentional and that's like what they're going for, that's still a problem, because it is a barrier between you and the characters. Like, I don't know. The movies I have the most fun with are the ones where I can really either identify with or like get behind, or at least I'm really entertained by the protagonist. And that I just don't get that here.
Well, speaking of things you can identify with, while all this mafia backstabbery bullshit's going on, some random miner comes across a massive discovery He finds the White Fire.
It wasn't that hidden.
No, it wasn't really, but you know, he found it. That's what's important. This guy, he got it. White Fire is a legendary diamond. It's huge. It looks like something you'd win for getting first place for beating the aggro crag and guts back in the day. Except when you touch it, it's like so radioactive it melts your skin. So you can't really like hold it up like a trophy.
Is the implication that the radioactivity made it big?
I think it's just a hunk of large radioactive material, and apparently it's so pretty people can't help but like gush over it.
So
I mean,
I'm a
it just looks like a diamond, but I mean neither Luke and I are diamond people, so we don't get it.
I'm a science moron. Like, are all diamonds radioactive? What is the association?
Oh. Diamonds are not radioactive.
Right. Well, that was what I thought. So why is this one?
Because it's a legendary diamond. This is a diamond that has like myths written about it, right? Like everyone's like, oh, it's the diamond of legend, White Fire. How the fuck does a diamond have stories, but then somehow remains underground? not excavated, right? Are we to assume that at some point some civilization unearthed this diamond and then lost it back underground? Or maybe they put it back because they realized it was too dangerous.
That's what I thought. The insinuation I got is that the people who knew about it, like knew the legend, most of them were terrified and they wanted it to stay hidden. But, you know, there are a few people who only see the monetary value and they have searched for it. That's how I read into the story anyway.
So the guy who finds it reports it to the manager, and the manager rewards him by pickaxing him to death.
Yep. In front of Ingrid. And Ingrid is like, why? Like, why did you do this? And he basically says, so like, we can have all the profit to ourselves.
It's really strange to me, because if he's planning on betraying Ingrid and Bo in the long run, wouldn't you just pickaxe her too?
That's, yes, I was confused. He says, I wrote it down. He says, you want him around telling everyone about this? It's ours. It's been there for a million years. Which I'm not sure what that part has to do with the first part, but maybe he is into her. Maybe he has like romantic designs.
Maybe. Movie definitely doesn't go that route, but you know, we can assume, sure. Why not?
Yeah, I don't know. It's indecipherable.
I like how the diamond is found in this large chamber, and then there just happens to be this perfect like viewing porthole for the diamond on the outside that people just look in, and it like radiates this bright light. You know, if it really was that radioactive, I'm pretty sure everybody in that scene has cancer.
So let me ask you a logistical question now. So later on in the movie, we see that all around the White Fire, there are lots of diamonds. Like, you know, at one point, a character basically gets a handful of them. Is the implication that the White Fire creates other diamonds?
No, I think it's just a big radioactive diamond that, you know, people are going apeshit for. Because they think they can sell it to somebody else. I don't think it's any kind of like goose that lays a golden egg or anything.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure. I wasn't sure what they were because it wasn't like those diamonds were embedded in the rock and they had to, you know, chisel them out. They were already perfectly formed diamonds laying around like on the surface. It just seemed very strange. But can we go ahead and talk about the scene where Ingrid is swimming naked?
Yeah, I think this is the part of the film where when I watched it for the first time, this is where my attention really snapped. Not because she's naked in a pool.
Right, lots of movies do that.
Right? Like, yeah, you know, it's cool, but it's, you know, I'm between 30 and 40 years old. I've seen that stuff. But what I hadn't seen is what Bo's reaction when he comes downstairs.
So first I will say that this did not entirely catch me off guard. I had some suspicion that the movie might incorporate this. But it's only because I've seen other movies, and I'm just, they're coming to mind now, where this dynamic exists between twins. So I think the best one, or the one that comes to mind first, is called Twins. Although I think it has another title. But it's a very similar dynamic between, you know, a male and female brother, sister. Here it doesn't reach that level, but Bo does stare at his sister naked and say something like, "It's a pity you're my sister." Like, and you know, that was weird enough, but then he also like she covers up with a towel and he snatches it away, and like he's basically spying on her while she's showering. Like, this is not played as if anything indiscreet is going on, but it seems nefarious in a way.
Nefarious? I don't know. It somehow seems normalized. Like, it's not presented if there's anything weird about what's going on.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I was reading into it, but I got the impression that Ingrid wasn't fully comfortable. Like, Bo seemed like an aggressor in that scene to me.
There's a lot of different ways to read this, but I think ultimately, the scene is presented in a way that that makes this seem commonplace to me, like not strange at all.
No,
which again is weird for the audience viewing it, but. It's just so matter of fact. It's like, oh, well, if you weren't my sister, like, that's a totally normal thing to say and a normal thing to put in your movie for your protagonist, who up to this point has been presented as a, you know, normal, like, roughneck hero type.
Yeah, but I didn't think their relationship seemed entirely platonic even before this. Like, at the very beginning of the movie, I debated whether, like, I didn't debate because I knew they were brother and sister, but it kept seeming like they were acting like a couple. At least that's the way it rubbed me. But during this scene, it seems to me like he is crossing a line for the first time and Ingrid is uncomfortable with it. And something is weird going on with her, because she gets out of the pool, she goes and showers and wraps herself in a towel. Bo comes and says that dinner's about to be ready, and they have this weird flirty, he stares at her naked body thing, and then she gets back in the pool.
Yeah, she's going for another quick swim.
why did she go back in the pool?
I mean, why? The director probably just wanted to show her off nude. In regards to the plot, I don't think there's any sort of greater meaning outside of they need her to stay outside for the next scene.
I thought, and again, I might be reading too.
Listen. They could have done this whole scene without Bo coming downstairs and doing his thing, and it wouldn't have changed the general plot at all. The director or the screenwriter or somebody specifically wanted Bo to come down those stairs and have that exchange before the movie just kept going.
Well, I do think it proves integral to the plot later, but we'll get to that. But here, I got the impression, and I might be reading this into it, that she got back in the pool because she was uncomfortable. It was an excuse to not walk in with him right then. to extricate herself from the situation. That's how it came off to me.
No, I don't think this movie's that deep. I really think this is just some sort of fetish thing thrown in there.
Well, we can't know unless there's a director's commentary out there, which there might be. I don't know. I didn't research that. But yeah, you're right. The main point is for her to be outside by herself so that Sophia and her goons can show up to kidnap her.
The original reason was the kidnap, yes. But after she manages to slit one of their throats with a knife, one of the goons kills her with a blow dart gun. A blow dart to the forehead.
Yep.
It's the future, Luke. The organized crime uses blowguns.
I mean, until maybe that's what it takes to take her out, because she managed to evade every other weapon in the movie.
They were
trying
not to kill her. They were trying not to. But the henchman with the blowgun had an ulterior motive. I don't know if you remember this because there's so much shit going on in this movie, but when the miner finds white fire, that goon is present on the work site and sees those two go off. Overhears the discussion and sees them go off to where it is. So he knows where white fire is, and I think there's supposed to be a subplot where he was going to try to get it for himself. And by eliminating Ingrid, that's one less person who knows where it is. This is something I only caught on a second viewing.
No, I didn't know it that clearly, but I kind of got that. But no, I was just I was quite impressed by the fact that wearing only a towel, she fights off, I don't know, like four guys and manages to slit one's throat.
And this is the same towel that just fell off when she was walking upstairs.
Yeah, right. It comes off twice, I think. It catches on the stair once, and then Bo pulls it off once. But after she's dead, this is when we hear that song for the first time, the awful romance song.
Again, the song's at the worst time.
because
a romantic ballad as a brother embraces his dead sister who he was just hitting on 10 minutes prior.
Yeah, and this is not essential to the plot. This is totally gratuitous. But also, it's not just Ingrid that dies. Sam's wife is killed during this scene, and the dog is killed during this scene.
Oh, yeah. They needed to ensure our main characters had a good reason for vengeance.
What did you think of the encounter between Sam and Bo after this, where Sam is trying to like offer advice?
Bo does not want to hear it, man. He's like, don't tell me about death. You know, I know all about death. I watched my parents die. You know, it's a throwback to the beginning of the film.
Yeah, I think we even see flashbacks.
Oh, we see flashbacks at the weirdest fucking times.
It is very strange, this made me dislike Bo more because he comes off as so whiny. It's like he's not just telling Sam something. He's like, I just can't. I think that's what he says. I just can't. I can't. I have to leave.
Yo, have some sympathy. This man just watched the love of his life and his sister die.
I'm not saying that there's no reason or cause for him to be upset. I get that. I'm just saying as an audience member, he's coming off as sort of pathetic and whiny here. And it turned me off.
Well, at least the whiny phase doesn't last very long, right? Because after the, I was going to say funeral, but they kind of just like stare longingly out into the ocean for a hot minute. The ocean in Istanbul.
Yeah.
they go to a bar gets absolutely plastered and meets Olga, who just happens to also be the same thin, blonde body type as his sister. And apparently she also sounds like Ingrid. She takes Bo home after a bar brawl where Sam has the beautiful idea of grooming this random bar stranger into a professional criminal so that they can steal Whitefire.
Yeah, so a couple of things. One is, why is this woman, Olga, so enamored with Bo? Like, she flat out tells him several times, I want to take you home. And he shoots her down each time. But what makes her so, and how did she get him home?
She's thirsty as fuck. I don't know what to tell you. Maybe she loves the mustache. It was a different time. And that time is the future, according to the 80s.
This is another, like, champagne and bullets situation.
Oh, God, it is, isn't it?
It is. Inexplicably enamored with this guy. But, yeah, so they decide that, you know, she can just take over for Ingrid.
You would need like a resume for this sort of thing, right?
I mean, that would probably be wise if you're bringing someone in on your heist. But I was just gonna say, I foresaw the Ingrid dying thing because I figured that it was gonna become a revenge story and that would give him motive and all of that. I did not foresee this plot development. And it's just a very odd choice.
Odd. Yeah, I think that's a word for it. So we're going to fast forward a little bit here, right?
Okay.
Ends up happening is Olga is basically groomed over a series of montages to try to be as close to Ingrid as possible, even learning foreign languages for no fucking reason because they're not used in the heist by the end of the film.
Yeah, can we play the scene where after he slaps her in the face because she insulted, he says, Ingrid, they have sort of a conversation about, you know, her joining the team.
Look, I don't know what it is, but I look at you and I open my mouth to say something. But what I feel is me, not her. And then I just screw it all up. I always do. I'm sorry. But you know, it's not every day that a girl gets to trade her life for a new one. And I'm so scared.
Okay.
I like the response. Okay.
Okay. there is that one scene where when she first calls out to him and he ignores it, she calls out again, but this time it's his actual sister in like the black dress.
Yes.
Ooh, ominous.
It's
so yeah, this whole romance is very convenient, her desperation to please him. He's wearing this lavender like neck scarf throughout the whole thing, which just makes it more absurd.
So I'm wondering something.
Yeah.
So there are several times leading up to Olga getting plastic surgery to look like Ingrid, where Bo seems to suggest that he doesn't want her to go through with it. So, like, he says it to Sam a couple of times, and he asks Olga a couple of times, like, are you sure you want to go through with this? Like, you don't need to go through with this. Why do you think he's hesitant about it?
Because he doesn't want to lose his sister a second time.
Right, but why does he think the plastic surgery is going to lead to the loss?
I don't think that's the reason. I think it's really like she is filling the same role as his sister, and he just doesn't want to lose her again. Like, he doesn't want to go through that again.
Right, but like she's in his life now and they've developed a romance, like that dynamic is going to exist regardless. What I was trying to figure out is I was trying to figure out if there was any degree of him being resistant because if she looked just like his sister, it would no longer make like be acceptable for them to be in a relationship together. Versus,
No, that is not what's happening. If anything, her looking like his sister, it is the fucking dream.
okay,
Bobo. That is the dream.
so that was my second theory, is I was wondering whether he wanted it for that reason. But if he wanted it for that reason, then it seems odd that he would seem resistant to it.
Okay.
Like,
Okay, let's look way too deep into this, right?
that's what we do.
Your beau, you know this woman is utterly head over heels for you, will do anything for you. You have the real estate, right? To say, "Oh man, I don't want you to do this. That's bad. Don't do it." But you really want her to do it. But like by showing the concern, it might like take away any second thoughts she may have to actually going through with it.
I don't know. It like I thought about that, but it doesn't strike me that way.
It just seems like there's a lot of psychological manipulation going on here on the part of Bo.
Well, so there's a moment where they're on the boat, because there's a lot of scenes that take place on the boat for some reason. But they're on the boat, and this is, they're talking about her getting the plastic surgery. And then she goes under deck or to the other side of the boat or something. And Sam says to Bo, "Don't worry, she'll go through with it." And Bo says, "I don't know if I want her to go through with it." So that doesn't seem like he's saying that to manipulate her, right? That's because she's not even there. That's him expressing a genuine, like, hesitation. And I just find that curious because I think everything else suggests that he has this like weird incestuous desire to be with his sister.
Yeah, it's weird, but it's also normalized within the film. So that's what makes White Fire a very strange film to watch, is that this guy is being really weird about his sister and no one seems to care. Maybe this is the future. This is the future that the director wanted.
I mean, I don't fully, I don't think I get the same level, like I don't get the same impression as you do, at least not to that degree. Like, it still feels unacceptable in the context of the movie. Like, Sam seems strangely okay with everything, but he also has like ulterior motives where, he wants to pull this heist off. But the other people in the movie, maybe I was reading into it, but they seem to respond oddly to the relationship between Beau and Ingrid.
Do they?
I got that impression, but it may have been me, projecting my own queasiness onto the film. But like when they were at the party, there's a scene where they throw a party to announce that like Ingrid is back, right? And during that party, that's where like Fred Williamson is there. He meets the new Ingrid, for the first time. And I think Sophia is there too. And I got the sense that all of them thought that there was something weird. And I think we're like that has a dual purpose because it's not really Ingrid, and we're supposed to, like, they're supposed to have some suspicion, right? So, like, that makes sense. But it also seems like in their interactions, they're like, why is this guy being so flirty with his sister? Like, it just seems like they're giving him odd glances and things.
Maybe it, but if the reactions were there, they weren't strong enough for me to pick up on.
And like I said, I could be projecting that into the film. I mean, you kind of have to do that with a movie like this because it doesn't, if you want to think and talk about it, right? Because it doesn't give you all of this psychological depth. So if we're going to make sense of the characters, like we have to imagine what's there. And I guess that's the way my mind went.
So I think this is kind of the point of the movie where the action really lulls, because we have Olga getting her training to become Ingrid, and then we're introduced to Fred Williamson, who is tracking Olga for a reason later revealed to be that she is actually in disfavor with a completely different group of criminals and is basically in hiding.
Yeah, can we briefly talk about the sort of commune where she goes to get the plastic surgery and Fred Williamson kind of tracks her to there as well? This is a very odd part of the movie.
It's like a new age hippie compound that's both a medical facility and I don't know, they got like giant bird cages and shit. I'd imagine they just filmed this in a botanical garden.
Yeah, it's all women who live there. I think there's like 10 or 12 of them, and they're overseen by a doctor who does the plastic surgery, and they're very affectionate towards the doctor, like, laying on her and leaning on her all the time. And so there's this weird, like, maternal but maybe sexual dynamic there. It kind of reminded me of the sort of pacifist people in Zardoz. But it was just very odd. It was a very odd thing to have in the movie. I mean, I'm happy it's here, but it was a strange choice.
Talk about ingrained misogyny. When Olga is first told that the doctor is a woman, she is in complete disbelief.
Yeah, I thought that was bizarre too.
A woman? Don't worry, she's good.
Yeah, I was very surprised by not that attitude, because that attitude probably would have been more common when this movie came out, but that the movie like bothered to put that conversation in there. So when after the surgery, when her and Beau sort of reunite and he sees the new Ingrid for the first time, who is now played by the original Ingrid actress, right? Did you think that was an effective choice?
Yeah. I mean, this is like a legendary plastic surgeon, right?
I don't know.
What kind of special effects were they supposed to do in 1984, right?
Maybe that's just not a plot point that should have been done. Like, I think you could have,
That's
there
the
was a
whole
way that you.
point. This movie is an entire vessel for the director to push his incest fetish on the audience. Like, this had to happen. This is the only way he could have made it societally acceptable for you to have sex with your sister or have a relationship at the least, is that you take a completely different woman and make her look like your sister.
Like,
I don't think it's much deeper than that.
okay, so I have to ask then. So this scene confuses me. There's a scene where after she looks like Ingrid now, and she's played by the Ingrid actress again. They're making out, right? And he starts to take off her top and expose her breasts, and then midway through like making out, he pulls away. And he looks uncomfortable. What is going on in that scene from your point of view?
He's like fighting. He's also imagining him and his sister running away as children from that generic military.
Right. Yeah, he has flashbacks to that. And then was I imagining it that after this scene, they are distant? They don't seem to be together anymore?
No, they're together. They're totally a couple.
I
Like,
don't know. I think there's something there. I what the impression I got was that during that scene, he suddenly realizes, like, yeah, she looks too much like my sister, and pulled away, and that they both kind of realized it wasn't going to work, and then they are distant in the next few scenes, and it, like, yeah, they're working with each other, but they don't seem to be romantic anymore. That was just the way I read it. I guess my overall point is I feel like the movie's more ambivalent about the incest theme. Like, I don't get the impression that this is like pushing a fetish on us and trying to normalize it. I get the impression that this is one more thing in here to just make it kind of sleazy, but I don't think it's really normal within the context of the film. I think there's a lot more ambivalence about it among the other characters and within Bo, at least at this point.
We may have to agree to disagree. I mean, as far as, you are right that after that one scene, they really tone down, if not completely remove, all the romantic encounters until the credits start rolling. But maybe that's because a producer finally came in and said, "Yo, quit it. Stop."
We also don't know, like, so many things can be changed in editing, and the music is so inappropriate in places, and there's a dub, so it's hard to know for sure what was intended. What else do we need to talk about before we wrap up?
Yo, let's talk about the finale, the very end.
Okay.
There's a lot of build up to it, with all the different factions kind of winding together in the plot to this pivotal moment where it's supposed to be a diamond heist, but like most things in this film, it just degrades into a shootout, and people are dying left and right, man. Like
2/3 of the cast dies.
It gets to the point where you don't know who's on which side. Like, some of the villains are wearing red and blue uniforms and some of them aren't. And then some of the good guys are just wearing regular clothes, and people are just dropping everywhere.
There's a scene where they talk about the uniforms. I didn't know why.
Because they kind of wanted to let you know which side you should be rooting for, which is the side that's not wearing the miners' uniforms. Either way, this scene is really bizarre because after all of this bloodshed, despite all the main antagonists being at the mine site, I think the only one that actually dies is the manager. The manager gets shot by Bo. And outside of that, like, Sophia doesn't die on camera, if at all. Her left-hand man doesn't die on camera, if at all. Fred Williamson is just sort of in the background waiting for everything to end. Once they get inside the chamber for Whitefire, no one ends up getting it because the diamond just wills itself, presumably, to explode. It just explodes, Luke. The diamond explodes. No one gets it.
Well, that's what happens with that level of radioactivity.
It no one gets the diamond. So Bo and Olga, well, Bo and Neo Ingrid, escape, only to be confronted by Fred Williamson, and then that gets tied up through Bo just bribing him, being like, "Yo, look, Olga doesn't look like Olga anymore. Here's a bunch of diamonds. Fuck off, please."
There, I do want to point out that throughout all of this climax, there's it's all shootout, but there's also a lot of throwing of dynamite and then slow motion explosions with people flying through the air while the romantic music plays.
Yeah, it's, while the ballad plays.
It's really disconcerting in some ways.
And my favorite part of the ending is just how abrupt it is, right? Like, you have Bo and Ingrid just basically walk into the sunset for maybe like 1.3 seconds, and then blue screen credits roll.
And The strangest thing about that ending to me is that they interweave flashbacks to when they were running away as kids, right? So like the movie comes full circle, but it's like the movie is literally believes that she is Ingrid. It's like it's flashing back to as if these same two people went through both these experiences when that's not the case.
Well, I mean, she identifies as Ingrid, and Bo is willing to accept her as Ingrid. Is that enough in the end?
It's weird that he immediately switched to calling her Ingrid.
Well,
Did you notice that?
oh gosh, maybe that was just part of the act, right? Because she was supposed to be like infiltrating, even though that never happened. That's the thing. This movie builds up a lot about there's going to be a big heist, and then it just turns into a shootout with no nuance. Like I thought the movie was going to build up to some sort of Olga actually had to pretend to be Ingrid to trick certain parties to letting her have access to the diamond, and that just never happened. All that training was for nothing. Really, she didn't even have to look like Ingrid at the end of the movie. It didn't matter. She could have been Olga.
No, yeah.
It was just a shootout.
I have no idea why they it, Sam thought it was important to throw a party so that everybody knew Ingrid was back, and I don't know why. I don't know why that was important. Like nobody needed to know any if she didn't use subterfuge, really. I don't know. We're in review territory. Let's give final thoughts and a rating out of four.
This movie is fucking jank, but I'm we are not gonna agree here. I have a soft spot for it. Just because this movie is so bold in what it tries to pull off, with especially with the bizarre romance arc, that I can't help but at least admire the tenacity it took to try to pull this off. Even if the execution was not that great, so much of the awkward scenes in this movie really make it for me. Like White Fire and the duet playing at the worst times. Outside of the White Fire playing at the beginning of the movie, I don't think there was a single other point where that music should have been played. And it's weird because this movie also has that like 70s, 60s action movie syndrome where you'll see a bunch of people getting shot and explosions and shit, but then there'll be no music going on. There'll be like dead silent on that front. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, you see it in a bunch of older James Bond films, but I mean, obviously that's fallen out of vogue with modern filmmaking. Now you got to have music during everything. Some movies just have a constant soundtrack and never let up. But I think this really awkward movie really does lend itself to a fun viewing experience. And for better or for worse, I'm going to remember parts of this film for a very long time. That said, it's not a good movie, but fucking amazing watch for me. I bigger surprise because the first time I watched it, I was just leaving it on, like some Eurocrime shit, whatever. And then as soon as the incest plot line hit, it becomes a completely different movie that's both disturbing and fun to talk about. And that's why I'm giving Whitefire 2 stars.
Yeah, there are a lot of things I enjoyed about this movie, and I'm glad that I've seen it. I don't know that, it's something that I'd want to sit down and watch again, but I'm glad I've seen it. So Leland and I talked recently about the film Champagne and Bullets, which we recorded a conversation that I'll post eventually. But this movie reminds me in some ways of that one. We've got a mustachioed, uncharacteristically macho main character, and a significant portion of the film is dedicated to like an uncomfortable, strange romantic subplot. And both of these movies are like really wacky and wild in some ways. And then they also have really long, boring stretches. But in the case of this movie, I really don't like the characters, aside from Fred Williamson. And that may be because he's a better actor, or it may be because I just have a pre-attachment to him. So I'm, you know, attaching more than is there. But I think he also is chewing the scenery in a way that the other people are not. But other than that, I don't really care about what happens to the characters. And that really limits me from, like, getting on board with the movie. But the movie is also not, like, totally incompetent. This isn't, like, an Executioner Part 2 situation, right? Like, the film is fine for a low-budget film in terms of, especially in comparison to other things like this that came out at the time. But Leland is right. What sets it apart is it's got just really wild twists and turns that even if you see them coming, the fact that they're all in one movie is unique. So I did have a fun time watching this. I was bored during portions. I think it was way too long. I think there would be easy ways to make this movie a lot better. But just because of like the what the fuck factor, I think everybody should just watch this once. I'm going to give it 2 stars as well. All right. That's it for Whitefire. If it's cool with you, I'll consult the 8-ball for next week's movie.
Spin away.
All right. So we're going to return to picking individual movies, and I'm going to shake up this 8-ball right now. All right. Next week, we are watching the 1973, going back to our home turf, exploitation movie, The Killing Kind. Are you familiar with this one?
I've heard the title, but I don't believe I've seen this.
I used to have the, I think Paragon put it out in a big box. I used to have that. And I got that out of a porn store, actually. And now I have the Unicorn release, which is pretty cool. But this is also kind of a perverse movie. In some ways, I don't want this to hype it too much because it's not this good. But in some ways, it reminds me of The Witch Who Came from the Sea.
Okay.
It is about a central psychopath character who is severely damaged for reasons that you will find out when you watch the movie. So everyone check out The Killing Kind if you haven't seen it before, from 1973. I think it is available to watch online, I imagine. If anyone out there cares to look into this, there's a weird connection between this movie and the 1980 movie The Attic. Have you ever seen that one, Leland?
There are so many movies titled The Attic. I don't know if I've seen the one you're talking about.
There's like, I think it's a woman, and then she's taking care of her father who's in a wheelchair, and she like resents him.
Maybe.
Anyway, those two characters are in this movie too. Otherwise, the movies are not related. So it's just an odd little connection. If anyone out there has seen The Attic or wants to watch The Attic along with The Killing Kind, I think they're a pretty good double feature. So check those out. Join us next week. Until then, you can follow us on Instagram at video.store.nightmares. Leland, any last words?
You know, it turns out Istanbul is sandwiched between a sea and, well, between two seas, the Black Sea and the Marinara Sea.
Yeah, so the sea access is accurate, but I don't think the desert is.
No, not the desert, but there's a lot of coastline. So maybe this the beginning war did happen in Turkey.
I also don't know if there's like an abundant diamond trade in Turkey. Like, does Turkey produce a lot of diamonds?
Man, neither of us know shit about diamonds.
Yeah, I really don't. I mean, only what I learned in Blood Diamond. That's the extent of my knowledge of the diamond trade, but it seems pretty shitty.
Anyway, thank you for your continued support.
Beautiful. Have a good one, everybody. Check out The Killing Kind, and we'll talk with you next time.
Ah.